Sebaton paused when he heard the shot. His breath caught in his chest, and he had to make a concerted effort to exhale. He was no stranger to gunfire, but the quietude in the city was so absolute, the avenues and buildings so deserted, that the sudden presence of violent noise alarmed him. He'd taken a similar route to the one Varte had been leading them down, only more circuitous. Deliberate detours had taken him further off the main streets, embedded him deeper into the warren. Arriving on Traoris from off-world with Varte and the others, there'd been no time to reconnoitre properly. Besides, the mission was supposed to have been relatively simple. Find the relic, leave and catch an atmospheric craft from the nearest spaceport heading corewards. This side of the rift it wouldn't be easy, but it was straightforward. The other task made it slightly more complex, but Sebaton was a pragmatist, so first things first. He'd studied maps of his location, but it was no substitute for seeing, getting a feel. Deep in the heart of Ranos, the Habs were more like hives, clustered together in dirty colonies. There were warehouses, silos, smokestacks and factorums, all pressing for space, all suffocating on top of and next to one another. But here he was anonymous. Here he was nothing more than a rat. And he hoped, like all vermin, his passage through Ranos would go largely unnoticed. It would take him longer to reach the shipyard, but at least he would reduce the risk of meeting up with whatever had ended Duugan, for the scout was certainly dead. So too Varte and Trio. He hadn't heard screams, even from Golak, but the men were gone. On reflection, Sebaton thought it might have been two shots, fired in such perfect unison that the first masked the second. Neither was silenced, which meant his pursuers had discarded stealth in favour of intimidation. They wanted him to know they were closing and that they had him in their trap. It was working. As he ran, Sebaton tried to gauge the distance from which the shot or shots had been taken, but panic was affecting his mental acuity. His legs were burning, lactic acid setting fire to his joints, and his chest ached. Leaden fear was adding to the strain on his body, and even though he regarded himself as fit and strong, the constant changes of direction were becoming taxing. He wanted to stop, get a breather, and his bearings, but survival instinct wouldn't let him. Stop now, die now. There was no help here. Sebaton knew that. He was alone, although he sensed the presence of something lurking in the stacked domiciles and factorums he had passed. Like standing next to a recently dug grave, death lingered about this place and was given form by a palpable sense of outrage and violation that had left a stain on everything around it at the point of life's ending. Eyes fixed ahead, he ignored the barren shells of buildings that were not quite empty, fearful that a side glance might reveal to him some revenant of that lingering death. But like a corpse bloated by putrefaction, an old memory rose to the surface of Sebaton's mind. He had been a child, no more than 8 years standard, in his first life, long before the war. A boy had died in his township, trawling in one of the drainage basins that bled out of Anatol Hive. The boy had waded in too deeply, got snagged on a piece of debris hidden by the murk of the water, and been dragged to his drowning as the machine processors that kept the basin churning activated, creating an artificial current. Though the town's men had dredged the water, no body was ever found. It was several months later that Sebaton had gone to the basin to see if there was treasure left to salvage in the water, excited by the dark reputation of the place. Standing at the Plascrete bank, all he found was sorrow and an abiding sense of rage. When he walked into the drainage basin, ankle-deep in the water, he saw something small and pale lurking beneath the surface. It filled him with such disquiet that he bolted and never returned, only later swearing that he felt something scrape at his skin, and finding 5 tiny wheals left in his flesh afterwards. The wounds never healed. Life to life, he carried them like the growing burden on his conscience, a reminder of his encounter. The memory had come unbidden, and Sebaton wondered if its resurfacing was a symptom of what was being done to Ranos, or had been stirred up by the presence of the artifact wrapped in cloth under his arm. Staying on the street and in the open suddenly felt unwise. The back of his neck itched, and though he didn't really want to enter any of the buildings that seemed to slowly close about him, Sebaton had no desire to be next in the hunter's crosshairs either. He saw a warehouse, its gate ajar, and headed for it. As he ducked inside the building, the darkness cloaking Sebaton intensified. He stayed still, allowing time for his vision to adjust. After a few minutes, an expansive storage yard stretched out in front of him. Above, crisscrossing gantries and beams put him in mind of a spider's web, as the moonlight streaming through an upper window hit them. The irony of that was not lost on Sebaton, for he was trapped, his arachnid predator looming close and preparing to pounce. Staying low, Sebaton ran across the store yard floor into a cluster of packing crates, drums and pipes. He'd seen no door or gate other than the one he'd entered by, so he assumed the exit was somewhere within this maze. He nervously twisted the ring on his finger, pausing at every junction, trying to tell the difference between sounds that were real and imagined. Halfway down a corridor, flanked on both sides by a rack of heavy pipes that were secured by metal cabling, Sebaton realized he wasn't alone. An infinitesimal movement, the minuscule shifting of metal as pressure was applied to it, had given the hunter away. Most ordinary men would have missed it, or dismissed it as cargo settling in its container. But Sebaton was not an ordinary man.